are listening to KBO Portland, KBOO Portland, KBOO, listener-sponsored community radio. Coming up at 11 on the Radio Zine, host Gene Bradley speaks with Dr. Tor Hansen about his new book, The Triumph of Seeds, How Grains, Nuts, Kernels, Pulses, and Pips Conquered the Plant Kingdom and Shaped Human History. At 11:30, we hear an excerpt from Radio EcoShock featuring an interview with George Karunas of Angry Planet and the solar-powered international musician known as Tortuga Blanku. Thanks for listening to KBOO, and thanks KBOO members for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Garden Spout, specializing in indoor gardening equipment, including horticultural lighting, environmental control, hydroponic and organic nutrients, and pest control. The Garden Spout is located at 4532 Southeast 63rd, just south of Foster in Portland. Information at 503-788-GROW. This KBOO program has also been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Hopworks Urban Brewery, committed to creating world-class food and organic beer as sustainably as possible at their carbon-neutral Eco Brew Pubs. Hopworks is located at Southeast 29th and Powell Boulevard, and Hopworks Bike Bar is at North Williams and Shaver. Available on draft and in bottles throughout Cascadia. Information at 503-232-HOPS or hopworksbeer.com. And now, stay tuned further on the Radio Zine as host Gene Bradley speaks with Dr. Tor Hansen about his new book, The Triumph of Seeds.
Hello, you're listening to KBOO Radio, your community radio station, 90.7 FM in Portland, Oregon, on the left side of the dial. I'm Gene Bradley, and today we're joined in the KBOO studios by Tor Hansen, and we're going to talk to him about his brand new book, The Triumph of Seeds. And the whole title of that book is The Triumph of Seeds, How Grains, Nuts, Kernels, Pulses, and Pips Conquered the Plant Kingdom and Shaped Human History. Tor Hansen is a conservation biologist and author. He's a Guggenheim Fellow, a Switzer Environmental Fellow. He lives with his wife and son in Washington State. And his previous books are Feathers, The Evolution of a Natural Miracle, and The Impenetrable Forest, Guerrilla Years in Uganda. Hello, Tor, and welcome back to KBOO. It's great to have you here. We really appreciate you coming by.
Well, it's nice to be here, Gene. Thanks for having me.
Now, just from the title, this sounds a little bit like a science fiction book, but actually it's a factual book, right?
Yeah, it's real science.
Real science. In the preface of your last book, Feathers, you quote an old saying from graduate writing programs about you don't choose what to write, it chooses you. How did you get chosen to write this book?
How did I get chosen? Well, there are two parts to the answer. The first comes really from my own research, in that I spent a good part of my doctoral work studying the seeds of big rainforest trees down in Central America, studying how the seeds were dispersed, studying how the genetics of the seeds would help us trace seeds and pollen across the landscape, and then seeing how the fragmentation of the rainforest affected those processes. So I had a real interest in seeds to begin with. And at the end of all that, after the papers were written, I realized I really didn't know how seeds worked. I understood quite a bit about how they were dispersed, but I didn't understand how they germinated or their dormancy. So a lot of things were still mysterious to me about seeds. And then years later, as I was looking for a new book topic, it so happens that my young son at the time, who was a very enthusiastic toddler, had this passion for seeds. And my wife and I weren't sure how this developed, but it just seemed that he'd always loved them, taking apart pieces of fruit and pulling out the seeds. And he also had a particular pronunciation for the word seed, and that, like many kids his age, he couldn't pronounce his S's very well. But instead of developing lisp or something like that, he simply chose to replace S sounds with something that he could say, a hard H. So what that meant was that every time he pulled some seeds out of a piece of fruit, he would hold them up in my direction and shout, "Heed!"
That's a message from above, I guess.
It seemed like that was the clincher. So I heeded the seeds, and I did choose to do a full book on seeds.
You start the book by reflecting back of being in the rainforest trying to crack open one of these giant seed pod kinds of things. And you talk at first about how seeds work. And one of the great things about this book is when you pose these questions, you start telling us a story about the people you talk to get the answers. And in this case, it's Carol and Jerry Baskin, who are professors at the University of Kentucky. Can you talk a little bit about them and how they explain to you how a seed actually works?
Marvelous, marvelous seed scientists who've spent 40 years or more now studying seeds, hundreds of research papers published. They're extremely knowledgeable. So they're one of the first people I turned to, and I talked with Carol quite a bit about seeds. And she summed it up in a wonderful way. She told me that a seed is a baby plant in a box with its wonderful little phrase sums up a number of the evolutionary when they evolved that gave them such a tremendous advantage over before seeds. Think about that phrase. Well, what does it mean? It's a baby. A baby is encapsulated in some kind of a coating for protection. It has its lunch in there, which means there's nutrition in the seed that is to feed the baby plant. And all of these things were new. And because they're there, they make seeds tremendously useful to us as well. And that's one of the aspects of the story that I find the most fascinating, is if you look at what makes seeds so successful in nature, you can identify these key traits, about five of them, that give them a real advantage. And then you learn that, in fact, those are the very same things that make us so dependent upon seeds for everything from the cotton in our clothes to the coffee in our cups.
Now, you have a great quote. You say, when it comes to stealing the food from baby plants, no animal is more accomplished than Homo sapiens. Can you just talk a little bit about the importance of seeds in the human diet and how this intertwining really got going?
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny to think about, but because that lunch is there in the seed, we can use it to nourish ourselves, which does mean we get more than half the calories in our diet by stealing food from babies. You know, it's exactly what we're doing. And it's a very old and deep relationship that's had a huge impact on the development not only of the, you know, our own evolution in terms of our seed-cracking jaws and skulls, but in the development of our culture as well, this long and intimate bond that we've had with seeds. When archaeologists are looking at a site and trying to determine when people shifted from exclusively hunting and gathering to an agricultural system, what they look for, in part, are seeds. And they start excavating, going looking for a point in time where the local grain or whatever staple seed was in that environment that the culture was using. They look for it to suddenly take a huge increase in size.
Right.
And as soon as they see that, they know that is when people began to select the best seeds to eat and began to select the plants that produce the best ones. They began to plant them. They began to cultivate them and make an even tastier and more delicious grain or what have you.
Seeds didn't come from outer space, but they haven't been on the planet since the beginning of time. You write that they, you know, that the traditional view is that sometime around the Carboniferous period, 358.9 million years ago,
yeah,
seeds started to really appear. And can you explain how they got started? What happened?
Yeah, so in terms of evolution, but you had these great forests, ferns, and horse, the terrestrial flora for millions. Seed plants eventually overtook that role, and now seed plants dominate 90-95% of our time. We still have mosses and ferns, but they're usually
backyard.
Yeah, that's true. There are certain situations,
rare exceptions, where
you want the horsetails out of your lawn or something. But at any rate, we know that the seeds evolved from spores. And the first step in that process is something that you can still see if you look at a little plant that grows in our flora here called a spike moss.
Mm-hmm.
Spike mosses are spore plants, but they have two different sizes of spores. Whereas most spore plants have a single size of tiny spore that drifts off in the breeze and lands in the mud someplace and goes through a whole separate generation that we never even see or notice before a new spore plant, a fern or moss, comes about. The spike mosses have separated the male and the female in the spore. So they have a big female spore, and they have these tiny little pollen-like male spores. So once you get that separation, this is the first step that led towards seeds. Another ancient spore plant did that way back at the end of the Devonian or the beginning of the Carboniferous, and seeds evolved from that system. Because once you have the female part separated from the male, then the plant can learn to hold on to that and make the male parts, which evolved into pollen, move through the air either by wind or by insect or what have you to fertilize the female part and grow into a seed right there on the parent plant.
And one of the marvelous pieces of the book is how you just reveal some of these, the web of life here. So can you talk about the pollinators and how they, their development, their existences became so intertwined with plants and seeds?
Yeah, it's a wonderful story. So again, it's this idea of you know, plant reproduction and how incredible seed plant sex, you know, has really evolved into being. Spore plant sex was dull, dull stuff. I mean, this is something that happened in the mud, out of sight, you know, and when they did it at all, it was usually with themselves. You know, it was not exciting stuff. But once you bring the plant sex out into the open, up onto the seed plants, you start to come up with all sorts of inventive ways of moving the pollen to meet up with the egg and form the seed. And the movement of that pollen then becomes incredibly diverse. The first thing that came along, perhaps, of course, was wind pollination. And we still have lots of things pollinated by wind.
Right.
But then you see the evolution of insects that transport pollen. And a particular group, of course, that we're familiar with, the bees. And this wonderful diversity of bees arising at the same time that the true flowering plants arose. And you see a great symbiosis here and co-evolution between bees and the plants whose pollen they were moving around, because the plants then, of course, start producing beautiful flowers to attract the bees in the first place. They start producing nectar that will give the bees a reward. And in some cases, the bees even gather the pollen itself, as honeybees do and bumblebees, to feed their larvae. And even the solitary bees gathering pollen or a combination of pollen and nectar to feed their larvae. So you have this great situation evolving where the bees are getting reward, and of course the plants are accomplishing their goal of moving pollen around, dusting these bees with pollen that they then take to the next flower. So, you know, seed plant sex is just marvelous, marvelous stuff.
And throughout the book, you refer to this as the seed strategies.
Yeah, yeah.
And this co-evolution it comes up again and again, the relationship and the trying things, they work, they don't work. Why did Darwin refer to this as abominable mystery? Why? Well, what bothered him about the development of seeds and insects?
Yeah, so Darwin used that phrase to try to describe, you know, the rapid evolution of the flowering plants. You know, you had seeds evolve way, you know, quite a long time ago, back in the Carboniferous, you know, late Devonian. And then we had what we call the naked seed plants, the gymnosperms, which we're very familiar with in the Pacific Northwest because conifers are naked seed plants and still dominate a large part of the landscape. So conifer relatives dominated for millions and millions of years. And then all of a sudden, you know, you had the evolution of the flowering plants, which are what they truly call the angiosperms, meaning the seed is encased in a vessel, as they say. So it has some sort of tissue surrounding the seed. And it's the flowering plants that now are the most common seed plants.
Right.
And gymnosperms still dominate certain ecosystems like ours in terms of coverage, but in terms of plant diversity, it's really rooted now in the flowering plants. And that mystified Darwin, how that could have happened so quickly. Because, of course, you know, his thinking about evolution was slow and incremental change.
Right.
But there are points in time where, you know, evolution moves in fast spurts. And this can be driven by, you know, a great new quote-unquote idea in evolution, encasing the seed in a vessel, and the co-evolution then of pollinators and the great diversity of strategies, if you will, for moving pollen around that all occurred with the evolution of the flowering plants.
And in a pretty short period of time,
in
by
terms
comparison.
Of evolution, yeah, it's a short, wow, you know, time frame.
Human beings' relationships to seeds, our intimate relationship with them, really, in addition to providing us sustenance, has given us insight into how the universe works or how life itself on Earth works. And you talk about Mendel and his experiments and how important that was and how it derived from humans' traditions with seeds. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, so Gregor Mendel, of course, is, you know, they call him the father of genetics, this brilliant monk in Moravia, you know, back in the 1850s, who in the monastery gardens started a series of experiments using pea plants, and he worked with other things too, but he's most famous for his pea experiments. And those experiments gave him a great insight into how information is passed from one generation to the next, how inheritance works. And he's the one who, although he didn't use the word gene, really understood that traits are passed in discrete units from one generation to the next, and that there are mathematical ways to predict what's going to happen to describe it. So the most famous trait that he looked at was, of course, the smooth versus the wrinkly peas.
Yeah.
And he understood that some genes are dominant and some are recessive, and that you get one from each parent. And depending on the combination that you have, you will display either the dominant or the recessive traits in certain ratios. So this, you know, is one of our greatest insights into the minutiae of how the world works. And it was made, of course, in a garden where someone was working with, you know, a plant that we are so familiar with, you know, that people had been at that point, you know, raising in their gardens and farms for thousands of years.
And saving the seed and breeding.
Saving the seeds, breeding, seeing the characteristics, you know, a familiarity, an intimate familiarity with the characteristics of this plant that certainly lent, you know, insight into his work in terms of what he chose to study. Here is, you know, something in the garden that he knew had all of these various traits.
Now, Origin of Species, Darwin's book published in 1859, Mendel is doing his research in 1866, 1870, but nobody hears about it. This is one of the fascinating stories.
Yeah, you know, these ideas were happening at the same time, and Mendel was very familiar with the Origin of Species. The monastery copy that's still there, you know, bears all sorts of his notes in the margins.
Wow.
But it's not clear, you know, how much of that he was able to relate to his own work exactly, because all of his notes were lost. The next abbot who came along in what must be the worst example of, you know, the impacts of a tidy house, you know, and it came through and just cleaned house and threw everything away. So we really only have Mendel's published major paper on it, which received very little attention at the time. I mean, really no attention at all. You know, to say it landed with a thud would be a mistake, because that implies it made any sound at all. I mean, no one paid any attention
to it. No sound came out of Monrovia or whatever?
No, it was very quiet. He knew he was onto something, and he described it in this paper and used methods that, you know, were ahead of their time in some way, very mathematical. But this was at a time when natural history was still in the process of adopting those sorts of, you know, more controlled experimental measures. And so his paper came across as a pretty tough read, and not that many people even bothered to wade through it. And so it didn't make a splash at the time. It wasn't until 30 or 40 years later that experimenters inadvertently repeated aspects of his experiment and started coming to the same conclusions and thought, aha, we're onto something, and then realized, oh, somebody figured this out decades ago. And he became famous after he was long gone.
Wow.
But during his lifetime, he received virtually no recognition for his work.
Encouragement to scientists everywhere.
Yeah, there's hope.
Now, it's as we speak, it's planting season in the Northwest. And because of that, I brought a seed packet in here. And I want to just – so we got visual props here on the radio.
Good.
I want to talk about one of the things you concept you spent some time talking about, which is seeds endure, the seeds going into dormancy. Now, this pack, because I'm an absent-minded gardener, was supposed to be used in 2012. But I have confidence, you know, and hope springs eternal, that I'm going to plant these and something's going to happen. Can you talk about how the idea of dormancy, how it works, and how it's affected human society?
Sure. Yeah, we have great faith in a seed. Thoreau, his last book was all about seeds,
right.
That's his phrase. But it's wonderful. We do. We have a trust that these things will germinate, even as you say, you're absent-minded. They're a little old, but maybe I'll plant a few more and I'll get something.
Yeah,
will. In most cases, you will, depending on the age of the seed. And that is all to do with this idea that seeds evolve to endure in the soil. And that concept of dormancy really retains an aura of mystery, even in the scientific community. It's a wonderful evolutionary strategy that plants have developed, the seed plants, to disperse their seeds not through space, but through time. And this is a fascinating idea. But we're familiar with the idea of seeds dispersing through space, getting away from the parent plant, whether it's the twirling maple seed with its beautiful wing or the fluff of dandelion blowing in the breeze, or whether it's fruit, you know, and animals being attracted to the fruit, eating it and carrying the seeds off. But dormancy allows the plant to place that seed in the future at a time when it's proper for it to germinate and grow. Because there are many times where you might have the conditions, say, for germination, but not the conditions that would support a tiny seedling.
Right.
For example, in our neck of the woods, if for certain plants, if they were to simply fall or be dispersed in the late summer or in the autumn and then immediately germinate, they could be wiped out by a freezing winter. So seeds instead are dormant, so that they'll last through the winter and only sprout after they've been exposed to a cold spell when it warms up and the spring comes along with its spring rains and warmth that will actually nurture the baby plant. And the diversity of strategies for dormancy and coming out of dormancy are incredible across the seed plant kingdom. And you have seeds in desert systems, of course, that can last for years, for decades, waiting for the right conditions to germinate, the right combination of season and light conditions and moisture, which is so rare in desert systems. You have seeds that are adapted to fire-dependent ecosystems, where the best time to germinate, of course, is after a fire wipes out whatever is in the understory and makes a lot of space for young plants to grow. And those seeds, many of them, won't germinate until they're exposed to wood smoke. So you can take those seeds and you could put them in the best potting soil from the hardware store, and you could put fertilizer in and water them diligently, staring at that little pot, and you would get nothing until they were exposed to smoke, which would break their dormancy and allow them to germinate.
You talk about humans saving seed. You talk about the National Seed Bank in Colorado, I think, but you also talk about a little place in Decorah, Iowa, that's close to my heart, Seed Savers Exchange. Mm. Can you talk about the kinds of things that people are doing nowadays, saving seeds, continuing to hold on to heirlooms? Can you talk about that work that Wheatleys are doing there?
Yeah, so the Seed Savers Exchange is a wonderful wonderful organization, and it's trying to keep alive in people's gardens the great variety of seeds and plant varieties, crop varieties, vegetables that we have developed over the course of our agricultural history. This intimate bond with the plants that we nurture has led to huge number of varieties of everything from tomatoes to cucumbers to wheat. And we've lost a lot of those varieties just over the last 100 years or so, when our system of agriculture has transitioned from small farms, local farms, to larger industrial settings where we depend on just a few varieties. So we're losing a lot of the history that we have in terms of crop variety.
Right.
So in the Seed Savers Exchange, what they've done is try to keep these seeds alive, not just in storage, but in people's gardens, by putting people together, by publishing a huge volume every year. It's like a phone book, a marvelous catalog.
Yes.
Where people from around the world list the seeds that they're saving and the varieties, and they describe them a little bit. And you can write to them and get those seeds from them for just, you know, enough money to cover the postage, and then try them in your own garden. And it keeps people actively planting these things and experimenting with them. And it helps those things stay around and also adapt to the changes that we're seeing in our environment now.
Now, which brings to mind a sort of deep topic that we just have a few minutes to talk about it, but you do talk about it in the book. The climate is changing. Rainfall is different. The engineering of seed and things is looming everywhere. What do you think the future of seeds are? I mean, here's an experiment that's 300 million years old. What do you think the future of seeds are? Because it's so intertwined with so much of life on our planet.
Right. Yeah. So there are a couple of aspects to that question. The future of seeds, of course, in terms of how we're preserving them. So the human relationship with seeds. And in that regard, you do have things looming like climate change, where things like the seed savers or the seed banks, where
yes.
seeds are stored, billions of seeds are stored in many varieties in cold vaults and things to save them for the future, where those things are going to come into play as we try to adjust our agriculture to new conditions. I asked this question of the director of the National Seed Bank in Fort Collins, mm-hmm. Colorado, and she said one word. She said sorghum. I said,
yes.
What? You know, and she said, sorghum, you know, that is the hot, dry grain.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to be eating a lot more sorghum in the future. So they have tens of thousands of varieties of sorghum seed in storage at the National Seed Bank, planning for that future when we turn more of our agricultural land over to planting sorghum. So you have that going on. You also have the great debate about genetic modification,
right.
which I find fascinating in that seeds are at the heart of it.
Right. Right.
You know, in an era where we're also producing everything from featherless chickens to
right.
goats that produce spider silk, you know, these sorts of things. But it's seeds that we feel compelled to rally around
right.
and defend.
Right.
And I think that speaks to this long, intimate cultural bond that we have with seeds and why it's so worthy to have this debate about what parameters we're going to put on that technology.
Right.
So those are two sort of cultural things we're
yeah.
struggling with. There's also another aspect of the future of seeds that I think is fascinating, and that is what's happening in nature. We're used to the idea of seed plants now being the dominant strategy for plant reproduction. I mean, they're extremely successful.
Right.
But of course, 400 million years ago, we would be having this interview talking about how successful and dominant the spore plants are.
Not to mention what we'd have for lunch.
Yeah, exactly. So there's nothing that is to say that seed plants will, over the course of evolutionary time, always dominate the flora.
Right.
And a wonderful example to look at about one possible future for seeds is a plant family that is highly evolved and perhaps the most diverse plant family in the world, and those are the orchids. Now, the orchids in the wild, you have 20, 25,000, 30,000 species no one knows. They're incredibly diverse in the tropics, very successful. But their seeds are almost completely unseed-like. They've done away with the nutrition. They've done away with, you know, things like bulky seed coats. They have no chemical defenses the way other seeds do. All of these things have been jettisoned, and the seeds themselves are just a few cells. They're just tiny. They're just the baby plant. Hardly any box or lunch involved.
Right.
And yet they're extremely successful. They're successful because they have developed a symbiotic relationship with fungi in the soil. And so the seed itself is tiny, drifts on the wind, and it relies on finding a patch of soil with just the right fungus that will nourish the seed and allow it to germinate and allow the plant to grow. So there are other strategies than what we're used to. And I think that's a fascinating one, talking about potentially, you know, one future for seeds.
Wow. Well, thank you so much. We've been talking to Tor Hansen about his marvelous new book, The Triumph of Seeds. So, Tor, thank you so much for coming by again, and good luck on your tour, and we look forward to your next book.
All right. Thanks so much,
thanks.
Gene.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. Up next, Radio EcoShock with host Alex Smith. But first, these messages.